Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 20 of Nutanix Weekly. I'm your host, Andy Weitz. I've got a special treat. Harvey Green is in the room with me today. Harvey, how's it going?
I'm doing great. How are you?
And what are you doing here today?
Working.
So some of you guys may know this, but Harvey is moving into a special role here at Zintegra, where he'll be leading up our Zintegra Gov business. I guess that's been officially announced for a week or two, right?
Yeah. Couple weeks, feels like.
But we're going to take our brand of EUC, cloud computing, Citrix, VMware, Microsoft, and most importantly, Nutanix to the state, local, education customers, as well as some federal customers. That's going to be a big focus of ours going forward. And
absolutely.
Harvey is going to be the man in charge over there.
Yes. Yes.
So we've got Gyra with us, Gyra Cox. Gyra, how's it going?
Gentlemen, doing well. How are y'all?
Good. I heard you were going to be in charge of Nutanix going forward. That's good.
You as always have better info than I do, Andy.
All right, tell the truth. Would you want that job?
No, absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
I love my job. I get to help people solve interesting problems with very little actual day-to-day responsibility. It's a fantastic combo. And anything besides this sounds like helping fewer people, and having to carry more responsibility. So that's a negative change. I actually, on the call right before this, I was helping consult on an implementation plan. And I was like, guys, what if we just skip all of this and do less work? And they're like, that's good. I like that. So
I, in 2009, I left a local partner here, consulting firm, and went to work for Citrix. And I'll never forget, my first day on the job was a Monday in Orlando for sales kickoff. And I got there about 5 o'clock, only to realize that everybody else got there earlier and they were all just having the greatest time in the bar and out playing basketball. And I had spent the whole morning working to get caught up so I could leave to go to the conference on my first day. And I got there and they were all just having a great time and partying. And then I realized, you know, that sales engineer gig, that's pretty good. You get to go do fun things, but you're not responsible for much of anything. Certainly not like consulting where you get off work at 5 or 6, go home, eat dinner, put the kids to bed, and go back to work for another 2 or 3 hours to figure out what it was that you couldn't get to work that day. Yeah, to work.
That could even be, you could say that's even best case. I mean, I've gotten stuff where it's like, hey, you touched this one thing like 3 years ago and now it broke. It's like, you're calling me why? like,
well, that's
you were the last one to touch it. Well, that's a sad
answer. I'm a sales engineer at Nutanix. I'm not allowed to touch anything.
Yeah.
Right. So I'll have to get you in contact with someone.
If the last person that touched something was like 3 years ago, like that's also kind of sad different reasons.
That is a problem.
Well, guys, we've decided to cover a blog by Derek Seaman, which is, did I say that right? Seaman? Seaman.
Yeah.
The topic. sorry. If we had outtakes, that would be one of them.
Yes.
New Nutanix Hybrid Cloud Reference Architecture version 3. And we chose this for a couple of reasons, but it's really interesting to me that there's a lot of new stuff and a lot of updates on old stuff. And I bet that we should spend a lot of time just talking about the old stuff for a while. Because a lot's still the same, but a lot's changed. And so let's jump in and talk about this guide. And let's start with one of the biggest, most important choices or items that Nutanix brings to the table. And that's hypervisor choice. Gyra, what are the supported hypervisors as of June 23rd, 2021? Today's the 23rd, right?
Yeah. So obviously ESXi and AHV, top two. The third one, of course, is Hyper-V. I usually throw it in with a joke about, if you're up for an adventure, right? If you really want to live on the having to Google lots of things kind of bleeding edge, just because it doesn't really see the kind of broad adoption that the first two do, but it is there for sure. And we see a handful of customers that deploy it, a lot more that move from it onto most commonly AHV, but also vSphere as well.
Well, and I found it interesting the way you said that. You said, of course, ESXi, and notice the fact you said ESXi, not vSphere, but ESXi. and you mentioned AHV, and you said AHV as if it was just a, you know, the other alternative to ESXi / vSphere. We've come a long way from people thinking AHV was a kind of a knockoff type hypervisor to a world where it's probably the most widely used hypervisor, or am I making that up?
No, for sure. Well, AHV most widely used, I probably wouldn't claim that. We probably see just about equal deployments though of it versus ESXi among the nodes we have that hit the field. So almost all of them leave the factory running AHV. And then, you know, of course they get refoundationed at the customer site to whatever the customer's choice is. And about half of those or so, based on our recent press releases, are vSphere.
So what would be the number one or two reasons why you would choose to use the Acropolis hypervisor? Which, by the way, this is an Andy moment. It drives me nuts when I hear people say Acropolis all the time, because they don't say hypervisor or operating system. They just say Acropolis. In this case, Acropolis hypervisor, AHV. What's the number one reason why people choose it?
So the number one is sort of surveying and confirming no requirement for a more complex hypervisor. If there's no need for it, then it's pretty much undeniable that managing AHV is simpler in the environment, right? All the management stays natively in Prism. All the functionality is there for snapshotting, cloning, replicating, even fancier stuff. Like I helped a customer today stand up a GPU pass-through for a VDI solution. So it's more of a, in my opinion, derived from a principle of let's go with the simplest option that meets the needs, right? And not inject more complexity where it's not needed.
Well, and I asked two technical guys that question and got a technical answer. So let's stay on the topic for a minute. What's the, what, if anything, are the shortcomings of using the Acropolis hypervisor?
Usually it's funny. It's almost analogous to, like, let's see, let me think back how far now, let's say 15 to 10 years ago, where it was lots of third-party software vendors who were like, well, we don't support virtualization. And it's like, well, if we do it right, your app can't even tell. So it's things like that, right? Where things that are like, we only support ESXi when, again, it's software that runs in a VM that basically can't even tell what hypervisor it's running on. But you know, if you're in a situation like that as a customer where you have to run software that is that opinionated and that sort of tightly gated, then of course, for sure, you know, we would never encourage you to take an unsupported path from your critical vendors.
And sometimes it's not a technically it won't work. It's just that we don't support it because we're not trained up on it. Would you say that's more often the case?
No, it could hardly even be that it could more often be that it's untested, right? They just, right. You know, it's certainly broadly an ESXi world still, right? So for on-prem workloads, which is why I usually tell when I, you know, internally we get other SEs that ask, you know, hey, does X run on AHV? Does Y run on AHV? And I usually tell them, hey, your first Google needs to be, does the vendor have like Azure, AWS, cloud appliances? If they do, it's a good indicator they probably are hypervisor agnostic.
Mm-hmm. And can you quantify that statement these days? Like how often, if you had 100 different workloads, what percent do you think would have a non-supported statement for AHV these days?
I probably couldn't put satisfying quantization against that. How about broadly, there's almost no workload in the data center we can't run, right? Whether it's backup or VoIP or load balancing or whatever, there's plenty of, and even, usually multiple solutions for each of those kind of silos for like, what could I choose between to run? The harder one, right? The thornier one usually is customers like, well, we only want to run X, right? Well, then we have to go check the matrix for X to see if they support it. But if they're like, hey, we're open to changing like the backup platform as we change out, you know, the primary storage and compute, well, then sure, you actually still have a plethora of options.
Yeah. Well, and then let me narrow this down because a lot of our listeners might be VDI focused. Anything in the VDI world specifically that would drive you to use AHV versus ESXi?
Yeah, let me borrow some of y'all's credence as well. In my opinion, I think AHV and AOS is the only platform that really lets like MCS shine, right? Like, I think MCS on AOS is a almost unparalleled experience compared to any other storage platform or virtualization platform, right? Because MCS specifically on AOS uses our rapid cloning technology. Right. Everything else is calling the hypervisor to say, hey, could you please copy these bits for me 200 times? And we just say, oh yeah, sure. It's all done in metadata. It's all done instantly. Yep. So that's an easy, one for sure.
And what you're pointing out there is simplicity without any additional componentry.
Yeah. And the other big one would be security, right? So in the EUC space, right, using stuff like Flow to get micro-segmentation, it's literally even a non-install. It comes from the factory on the nodes that you're going to run to run AHV. You literally just turn it on and tell it, separate dev from prod, separate contractors from databases, if they're unless they're a contracted DBA. You know, don't let the interns get to anything but the internet. You know, that kind of policy is easy to implement.
Right. All right, so take your technical hats off for a reason. What's another good reason to run a Crossless hypervisor?
Oh, well, yeah, obviously it's included, yeah.
And yeah. As much as we want to talk about, you know, it being on par or it being a good technical choice, at the end of the day, if it just cuts out a big chunk of the cost, that's probably the prevailing reason.
Well, yeah, for sure, right? It's included, but it also includes a bunch of analytics, metrics, replication. Like there's a whole kind of broad ecosystem of like other solutions that usually you have to bolt onto your hypervisor that we just do natively, right? So replication for DR. I showed a customer last week, like, here is your read write blend, here is your IO size, average read size, average write size. You know, is it coming from which tier of storage, right? Flash versus HDD, what do we think is hot versus cold? All these kind of analytics that, you know, when I used to sell traditional storage, talking to a customer, I'd ask them questions and they never knew, right? Because they hadn't bought the $1 million analytics package with their last storage array to tell me what their data looks like and how it behaves. With Nutanix, we just give it to you for free, right? That's all just there in Prism.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of a, you know, analogy to that. And I think it's the fact that you can buy just about a basic vehicle these days, and it comes up with a basic backup camera, things that back in the day you had to pay for that.
Right.
If you were cheap like me, you just wouldn't pay for it. You just keep using the mirrors, which I still use the mirrors, but having that backup camera when I get really close is super powerful.
Now the mirror, that the top down view from the bumper is just, I mean, mirrors can't even do that.
Yep. All right. Next section about the old school pieces is hardware choice. Harvey, you want to kind of just tell us what that means in general?
So yeah. As far as what Nutanix works with, it comes with a wide variety of hardware choices. They do have their own hardware that you can get that is Nutanix branded. You also have, let's see if I can do this correctly without leaving anybody out. You have HPE, Cisco, Lenovo. I already feel like I'm leaving somebody out. HPE, Cisco, Lenovo.
Anything Texas flavored?
What was that?
Anything Texas flavored, Harvey?
Texas.
Round Rock specifically?
Four-letter word? Often referred to as a four-letter word?
I'm blanking.
You know, dim guys.
Oh, Dell.
Yep.
Yeah, I almost made it. I did pretty good.
All good. I feel like I've heard globally the list is up to like maybe 12 or 15-ish flavors. It's a ton, right? So we even have like specially hardened stuff that the military likes to use, some other stuff that is popular in Asia. But yeah, tons of flavors of hardware choice. Because, you know, my view of it, right, is the software only appreciates in value, right? You buy whatever you buy, like Windows Server as a license. It never loses functionality. It does more, if anything, over time as new features get added. The software becomes an asset that only appreciates in value. The hardware depreciates, right? And so you want the flexibility to negotiate with your providers to say, what, you know, I have a need, who wants to meet my need, right? Who, like, you can, you know, compare solutions from multiple offerings, knowing that you get the same experience of running on all of them when you run Nutanix on them.
So Jared, which ones can you buy it from the manufacturer with the operating system already installed?
Yeah, the factory integration is on HPE, Lenovo, and Dell nodes, and of course our NX offering.
And then the others, it's supported by you guys but you install it, or your consulting firm installs it.
Yeah, we actually call it. Yeah, we actually meet in the field, right? So a partner like Zintegra would can do that foundation for other stuff like UCS comes to mind, at the partner site or at an integration area or before it hits the dock or whatever. Yeah, and if I missed anything there, that's just on me.
So regarding this one, this hardware choice, is there something new, or are we just revisiting the state of the union with this document?
With this, so in the context of a reference architecture, right, this is probably going to go back to, in some sense, operationally, right? What is your team familiar with, right? If you're more familiar with managing HP nodes, Cisco nodes at scale, then that certainly has some value as you're considering what you should implement in your data center. And that's, at a high level, that's what I view a reference architecture as helping you understand, is what questions you need to be answering, even if your design looks different than what is laid out in the paper here. So it's what decisions and justifications and documentation should you have as you're putting together a, here's our new plan for data center A or cloud B or whatever.
Right. Well, that probably ties right into the next one, which is management layer, which, you know, Nutanix has its own management layer, but you're also probably interacting with some of those third-party ones if you choose to use another hardware manufacturer. What's new or what's important to know at these days compared to the previous releases of the architecture as far as the management layer?
So the management, yeah, stays common. Of course, no matter what you pick there for hypervisor, to your point, yeah, for sure. If it's ESXi, then that does keep vCenter also deployed as part of the architecture. So they need the vCenter high availability model, plus, you know, and running alongside Prism as well for the storage management, monitoring, hardware health monitoring, automation, all that good stuff. So so it does keep some more VMs in play there, some more layers in the cake, I guess, if you will. But yeah, the management fundamentally does stay, you know, Prism Element manages a cluster, Prism Central manages multiple clusters, all the way up to representing like an availability zone. So if I had like East Coast, West Coast, that could be a good use case to run like an East Coast, West Coast Prism Central. They can each see each other's VMs. They can each orchestrate things through comm. You probably would pick one of those to be kind of your leader versus a follower in a distributed architecture.
And then automation, that's...
Yeah, so automation... If I had to think about what I would think about from a reference architecture perspective, it's meeting my team where they are on the automation journey, right? So whether that's something kind of codeless, right? Where I can do it right through the GUI, where it's this action X and then Y and then Z, and then run all this at, you know, on Friday at 10 p.m., almost like a Windows task scheduler level of automation. You can do that through Prism Central, you know, today, right? Through playbooks and the codeless automation. You can take that all the way up to stuff like Calm, where I'm calling APIs and I can deploy VMs and call into the guest to do, you know, day zero, day one deployments, and across multiple hypervisors, multiple hardware, multiple clouds. So what's my team's propensity for automation? How much am I looking to, where am I looking to start that journey or continue it or keep pushing it to the next level, right? Because I, as an IT leader, I would have to do that to keep getting the sort of gains and efficiency out of the team so that we can take on more and more projects for the business by making each task take less and less time.
Next bullet here is around security. Now, I know we're going to talk about flow up above here, but as far as your security design, does a lot of this still fall into the plays of, you know, segmenting certain traffic like storage traffic and VM traffic and management traffic, or is there more to it than that as far as the architecture goes?
I think that all stays in play for sure, right? Plus things that are, you know, that virtualization is in orbit around, right? Like the data center edge, your high-level routers, top-of-rack administration, all those things that need security considerations, things that run on the cluster, virtual load balancers and so forth, you know, virtual taps for traffic, you know, capture and so forth. But also, I think here, right, a big significant section would be, you know, what are my threats, right? Ransomware, of course, is hugely top of mind here. How do I, how do I think about what can attack me? But also, I feel like if I was going to coach the customers I talk to, there's a big need for more imagination, more scenarios around how do I recover from like a worst day of my life type of event, not just spend all my energy trying to prevent it, right? Like there's less planning put into assuming full compromise of everything with an IP on the network. And how do I recover from that as quickly as possible? What's minimum viable? What do I do first? That it would really be interesting to see written out as a kind of a, even just a back of the napkin game plan so that, you know, when, not if that's needed, you know, the team can mobilize faster and start at, you know, acting to the plan.
So you guys are both talking to customers all the time. What are you seeing people talk about these days from a, you know, recovery time perspective?
Yeah.
I think that varies a lot. You know, that you got your people like in healthcare who really need it very fast. They need to have as little downtime as possible because people's lives are actually dependent upon it. People who are just working in construction, I guess, for example, where if they don't have access to a blueprint or something like that, then they have a little time where they have some ability to recover, where they don't have to get back to that for, you know, maybe as much as a day or so. So I think it varies a lot, you know, by industry, but also by the way that the company is taking care of things as well.
How much do you think leadership plays a role in that? So you got industry X, two people both in industry X,
yeah,
where, you know, the leadership is, okay, our recovery time objective is 24 hours, whereas someone else might be, you know, 48 hours.
I think leadership plays a huge role in that. Different people have different standards, what they will take, what they won't take. Ultimately, the business hopefully isn't harmed by it or harmed by, you know, somebody taking longer than they should. But at the same time, you know, not just leadership, but budget plays a big role in that too. So if leadership isn't seeing the value in being able to, you know, secure or back up or, you know, prepare themselves for whatever's coming from a information security perspective, then, you know, they're not going to spend in order to bring down that recovery time objective and or see why that's important until maybe they get hit, which hopefully, you know, doesn't happen. But that's kind of what opens people's eyes to that conversation.
Jaira, what do you recovery point objectives? What do you see in people with not recovery time? That's what Harvey answered, and you're welcome to chime in on that too. But recovery point, are they trying to get back to the minute before it all happened, or are they okay going back a day or so?
Yeah, or somewhere in between, right? Like it's pretty easy, especially with the Nutanix platform, to configure. I want a whole bunch of the last couple hours, right? Maybe hourly for the last 8 hours, and then also give me the last couple of nightlies and keep a week or two around as well. So, you know, depending on how far back I want to roll back. What I still worry about is things that can persist longer than that. You know, like it's what if there's threats out there that can lay dormant for a while. And you know, if it was 3 weeks old, right, I'm not really probably going to encourage you to keep 3 week old snapshots around on your system. Or from a viability standpoint, do you really feel like, what's your confidence rating that you can roll back any given VM or group of VMs back to 3 weeks ago and everything just works great, right? Probably not. You probably need some business process or way to diff the data of the last 3 weeks and say, selectively bring in, you know, data from infected VM that you've scanned to say, I need to take a 3 week old snapshot and try to bring it up to speed with the last 3 weeks of changes, you know, as safely and quickly as possible. Yeah. It's almost like if you think of your application diagram as a dartboard, you know, like do the thought exercises of throw a dart at the dartboard once a week and say, what if we lost that VM and it was unrecoverable? You know, how would we survive? Right. Almost like what, you know, what, like what a chaos monkey does for Netflix, you know, all day, every day, right. Route around the failure.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say too, you know, even looking at that situation and talking about having to bring data back that's 3 weeks old. I mean, I'm kind of the opinion that you would really want to selectively do that as much as possible, because just having to go back that far, I mean, you just think some of this data could easily be, you know, due to some people who have worked together on a document or a group of documents over the past 3 weeks and they've been collaborating on it. It would be very hard to bring that data back 3 weeks ago and then ask them to just go do that again. I mean, if it's a possibility that maybe you still have that file, but not the rest of the VM. So, I mean, there's lots to think about when you start having that part of the conversation, and, you know, lots of potential effort, but again, you know, like Jira was talking about, you do have lots of options within Prism to make it so that you don't have to, you know, go back and do something that drastic if you can, or if you, you know, thought about things ahead of time and set it up so that you've got a recovery plan that you can take that hopefully will bring you out of a jam if you ever find yourself in one.
So here's a real world scenario for you guys that I'd be curious. So in VDI world, user logs off, non-persistent, and the virtual desktop reboots back to the master image, right?
Right.
What if the bad stuff is in your master image?
Sure.
How often should people be, instead of just cleaning out the closet all the time, you know, moving, getting a new house? And I don't mean that necessarily exactly that way, but how often should people be rebuilding their master image just to make sure whatever it is they're trying to avoid isn't just already laying in an image from way back?
Yeah, I referenced it now several months ago on the podcast. Yay for having a mature, long-running podcast now that I can say that. We had one of our automation experts demo process, right, whereby it's a Jenkins, you know, software integration process that builds a completely net new gold master image every single night. Here's the ISO, here's all the updates, here's the software to inject. So whenever you go to refresh a pool, you just pick up the newest gold master build that can do automated testing and verify that it's good and fit for purpose. You're never using a gold master image that is the patch of last month, which is the patch of the months prior, which is the patch of the months before that. No need to carry that baggage along, right? Just pick a fresh one the way you would and apply like a CI/CD process to your gold master. I'll say management, but really actually it moves a lot of management off of a human's plate and lets a machine go do it for you.
Right. Yeah. The idea of redoing it every night. I wake up every morning. First thing I do is look at my phone to figure out what blew up.
Right.
Well, no. So you're in for this exact example, you're letting a human be the arbiter between picking a gold master build and putting it into production as a source for a pool. Mm-hmm. Right. You wake up every, you know, maybe you wake up 30 days a month, hopefully, and 29 days of those days, you don't use the one that built last night. But when you do need to go build a new pool, you can grab the latest one, test it real fast, throw it in front of pilot users, and then roll it into production. So you're the gateway there. It's just that you never have to go boot it up or clone it, patch all of the things, sysprep it, shut it back down, all that jazz.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think we've talked a little bit about networking, which is the next bullet in some of these security conversations. And I also talked about, you know, performance pieces where you're segmenting traffic. What, if anything, has changed in the world of networking as it relates to the latest architecture?
I was helping a customer walk through this doc, you know, today, 2021. You know, as usual, some of the baggage we keep carrying forward is brittle application architectures. You know, the more you say things like, this VM can't be re-IP'd, the more complexity you have in a stack for things like DR planning or scale out, or even planning for just high availability, right? So keep a focus on your application vendors and software selection to say, you know, how can we try to step closer to the future, right? Like, not even all the way to a full service mesh, but like, can we use DNS to reference the server versus a hard-coded old IP address, you know, because then my DR plan becomes failover and just update DNS records instead of trying to move VLANs or stretch layer two or other kind of, you know, craziness that we can make traditional infrastructure do, but boy, we sure all love not having to do that, you know?
Yeah, I worked with a client just the other week that had a flat network, no VLANs, no anything. And I appreciated without a doubt the simplicity of it for the POC. But at the same time, you know, hugely concerning in terms of just traffic in general, as right. well as security of access to things.
Yeah, that's scary nowadays, honestly. Flat network, I was going to say used to be the easiest. I mean, I guess it still is the easiest, but it is the easiest in a good way, and it's the easiest in the most horrible way possible. you know, one thing comes in and it literally has access to everything else.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I guess I would take the other side of the coin there and say VLANs themselves really aren't security boundaries, and
yeah.
treat them like they are. That's where you find those shops where it's like, oh yeah, it's 2 months to get a port opened, right? Or it's 6 weeks to bring a new IP online, making the ACLs on the VLANs enforce security, like it hurts agility in a lot of ways, right? And I say this, of course, sitting here with a very easy to use, quick to implement, you know, software defined micro segmentation offering. But like, that's why those things exist, is because, you know, when I can take a flat network with zero VLANs and say, and now it's more secure than even like a you know, 100 VLANs with ACLs and all that stuff, because it can even be responsive, right? It can change VM security posture based on who's logged into the VM. That's cooler, it's faster, it's more secure, and it's not going to slow down the business from actually doing delivery of new objectives.
I feel like you just called me a spoiled brat for having access to Flow.
Hey, isn't Flow cool?
Well, and so I got to play the old guy card in this conversation. The first time I saw VLANs, it wasn't about security. It was about traffic and performance and broadcast traffic.
Right.
Security sure. was a byproduct of.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You need VLANs for scale. Absolutely. Right. I don't look at a flat network and say, and my security, you know, back of the neck hairs don't stand up.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and that's assuming that we are good administrators and we're leaving firewall on at the system level and we're only allowing what needs to be allowed. And you guys probably like, you walk into shops today, we're like, oh, just turn that firewall off. Just turn it off. Like, so you just turn it off? That turn it off for everything because it, you know, makes it hard. But hard's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
So the next topic here is business continuity and DR. I would use this as an opportunity to say they're not the same things, right? There's DR and there's business continuity. I think we've talked about DR to some degree, but business continuity, what's the latest on what you guys are talking about in the record and the reference architecture?
Yeah, it probably blends together. A lot of stuff we've touched on, right, is, you know, thinking through the worst case scenarios, right? And how do we get the business back up and running when we find out that those kind of game plans are needed? So whether that's, to your point, you're right, for sure, not necessarily recovering from a disaster, like it could be even recovering at the same site, right? Because maybe we haven't had a site failure event. Or how about this? If your traditional disaster recovery planning is a little dusty, I would almost say the things that used to trigger DR failovers happen less often than other disruptive events these days, right? So your data center level power outages, your sole ISP outages. I mean, everything has a bad day, right? And you still have like bad weather on the internet. But in general, I think you find security breaches, ransomware events, even human failures, right? Like a dropped table on the wrong database server, that kind of stuff. I would take a bet with no perspective other than my own, that kind of stuff happens more often than true, the bad things you wrote disaster recovery plans to address.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then going to the next bullet is multi-site. I mean, to some degree, if you're multi-site hot or hot, really warm, the need for DR kind of goes away. This comes less important, and that true business resiliency, business continuity happens as a byproduct of your multi-site architecture?
Yeah, I mean, really, from top to bottom, right? Reference architecture is all about risk management, documenting decisions, and multi-site really becomes an extension of, you know, how many availability zones do I choose to have, right? That's almost a whiteboard level decision, because then an availability zone can turn into anything, right? Is it another room at the same colo? Is it a different colo in another state? Is it a cloud? Is it on-prem? All these things can derive from that, but fundamentally, the higher level, how many availability zones do I feel like we need to mitigate risk, is almost where you start with that one, right? And then how you do multi-site beyond that, a lot of the other things we touched on, you know, from DNS and stretch layer two, or hopefully trying to avoid that, or, you know, can my applications re-IP? How do my end users connect to the applications I run at these sites? All informs a kind of multi-site design.
Well, along this line, I want to ask you to help explain clusters and when a cluster is allowed to be outside of the same high-speed local area network, if ever.
Sure. Sorry, go ahead. Question there?
Yeah, well, like if I have two data centers in the same building that are on the separate VLANs, but high-speed connected with multiple connectivity capabilities between the two of them, at what point does a cluster need to be limited to its geographic footprint?
Let me think here. So in general, from like a availability planning for the cluster, there's a few different rules of thumb to think about to keep in play in all the designs. From any node to any other node in the cluster, we want to do, I think the rule is three network hops. So NIC to switch A, switch A to switch B back to node B, right? So we went from node to switch to node, three hops there. Okay. So that's the kind of we call that like a geographic or a physical kind of way to think about hops and how we want to get from node to node. What we don't want to do is go node to switch to like spine switch back to a separate switch, right now three switches, and then down to another node. So that's probably too many hops for a performant cluster. What else?
And that's because your writes are only officially written once they've been written in both places. Is that the key component?
I think, well, that's true that we do that, right? That we certainly don't acknowledge any writes back to a virtual machine until we've gotten the required number of remote acknowledgments, either one for an RF2 cluster or two for an RF3 cluster. But also, it's probably almost rare. It's almost, I'd say rarely or never required. Like I never have to have a switch to spine switch to other switch type of design to make a cluster work, right? We're talking about clusters that still fundamentally run as virtualization clusters, right? So there's very few like 64 node clusters in the world, right? We're talking about most customers would run, you know, 24-ish node clusters or smaller, right? Because that's kind of another good size to kind of think about for a probably close to maximum size for a cluster what I want to run in production. Mm-hmm. If I run a 64 node cluster, that's great, but what does my HA planning look like right for that? You know, if I lost a whole cabinet of nodes, am I going to keep that cluster like 30% empty, and now I'm wasting 30% of 64 nodes just so I can tolerate like a cabinet power failure event? I could, but it just has really interesting design implications when I do that. So I rarely need that kind of switch complexity to make a cluster function at rational cluster sizes, I'll say. Rational is kind of a loaded word there, but I'll be opinionated on that one. So I rarely do I need that. The more common constraint is most customer networks would dare to say you'd hit some gremlins, right, around latency, around switching, if you added that many hops and that kind of complexity to a network design. When I do want to have, you know, absolutely line rate networking from node to node, mm-hmm. you know, so you're taking a cluster, you're making it run as fast as the network that can support it. And the more switches I have to hop through, there's a computer science level penalty that you just have to pay there, right? That you can't really get around. Beyond that, like from a spanning, like some customers, you know, if like manufacturing specifically often asks about like, can I run one cluster across two rooms in one factory. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly interesting. I get why people ask that. In general, the principle that we bring in there is, you know, pick your failure, right? We want to be able to accommodate any failure and keep on running as a cluster, right? This is what we do. But if the failure was the link between those two rooms, what survives, right? Is either of those surviving rooms going to be big enough to have a quorum of nodes? If you have a 3-node cluster, do I put 2 in one and 1 in the other? Or do I do 2 and 2? If I've lost the link there, now I've almost split-brained the cluster. I've lost 2 nodes out of my 4 nodes. And I've exceeded what the cluster can tolerate from a failure standpoint. Almost what any cluster would do from a distributed systems perspective. So what's better there is we can do stuff like a metro cluster, right? I can put 3 nodes in one room, 3 nodes in the other, and each of those is a separate AOS cluster, but I can do synchronous writes between them. And then I can have anything fail, including one entire room blow up. The surviving nodes will remain the cluster that they already have formed, and like vSphere HA, or coming soon, you know, functionality for AHV will kick in to say, light up those remaining VMs that got affected by that, you know, physical blast, perhaps, boot those VMs up on the surviving nodes.
And so, Gyra, that is the concept of a metro cluster, you called it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2 separate AOS clusters with synchronous storage. Mm-hmm. And then the hypervisor, today it's vSphere, you know, can just use its standard HA constructs to say, the VM failed over here, booted up over here on a surviving node.
And that other side of the cluster would do the same thing at the same time?
Yeah, with a metro cluster, right? Which today is one reason why we need ESXi, to your previous question. So for a metro cluster, you know, I can run VMs in room A, VMs in room B, or site A, site B. And whichever side fails, you know, it's like an HA event. They will boot back up on the survivor cluster.
Yeah. And if it's the link in between the two that fails, they'll both come up and be holistically running.
So for that, we run a lightweight metro appliance that just serves as the tiebreaker, right? Whichever one can see the metro witness is the one that's like authorized to proceed forward in time and avoid that kind of split brain condition.
And is that, did that encompass the concept of a stretch cluster, or was that the previous idea of running across, from one multiple rooms or something with connectivity in between it? What's a stretch cluster?
We really don't want to do a stretch cluster, right? We don't want a cluster that spans beyond an availability zone, yeah, whatever that is, right? So it's whether that's switches or physical or power, if a failure can occur and partition the cluster, that's not a great design.
And for the record, you didn't say that. I was just wanting clarification of what that
I wasn't sure. I say a lot.
Well, metro cluster is really what I was looking for in terms of an answer, and stretch cluster was the thing that I was looking to validate.
And it's meaningful to think about which layer are we talking about, right? So I am synchronizing the storage layers, and I'm sort of, if I was going to diagram it, I'm stretching the hypervisor HA layer, right? If I have a failure on, let's say I've got 3 and 3 nodes, mm-hmm, a failure on node 2, the VM can restart on node 5. So the hypervisor management control plane, vCenter, can say, I see one cluster of 6 nodes. Nutanix sees 2 clusters of 3 nodes, and we keep the storage in sync. That's why the VMs are allowed to restart on either survivor side.
Yeah. Well, I've jumped back up to the top here where there's a bunch of new stuff that's covered in the document, and we've done a great job covering this so far, but we're going to run out of time. Let's hit these probably really quickly and succinctly. Prism operations.
Yeah, so really for all these, right, like just, you know, consider, like, read through the reference architecture, look through the decision points and justifications, and then the implications that those decisions have for how to deploy really all of these, right, and make them part of your operations. So yeah, Prism operations, right, for, a lot of workload management, finding, are my VMs right-sized? Because, you know, Nutanix is a fantastic premium product for running fantastic on-prem clouds or hybrid clouds. But we want you to be well-armed with the data to say, are my VMs appropriately sized, right? If they're oversized, you chew up your storage, chew up the compute too fast, and it's not as defensible from like a I need to buy more of it perspective. So we want you to be well-armed to say my VMs are right-sized. They're not wasteful, right? Eliminate waste in the VMs as deployed, right? If the developer wants 16 gigs of memory but uses 4, hey, let's consider, you know, whittling that back.
Right. Nutanix clusters for hybrid and multi-cloud operations.
Yeah. So, you know, certainly a fantastic option for talking about, like Harvey and I have done this together, you know, how do we help a customer design for, I need a disaster recovery zone, right? I need another availability zone. But say if that's for VDI, I don't need a lot most days, right? Just enough to hold my golden images and then an ability to get more resources when I have a disaster, right? And clusters is a fantastic way to do that because I can run a small cluster most of the time, replicate to it. When I have the disaster, you know, more nodes are minutes away, quite literally. Yeah. Maybe like 30, 40 minutes, but still minutes.
Next bullet is Flow for micro-segmentation, which I think we've hit pretty hard and talked about how it's got hard.
Yeah, and making that part of your data center design has upstream impacts on maybe simpler network and switch level config designs.
And probably from a VDI guy's perspective, the Nutanix files piece and having local file access to very important high access or at least need to have rapid loading of files and reads and writes Nutanix files.
Yeah, I mean I think EUC is interesting there specifically because now I can have a high performant, large at scale end user computing environment, and the files environment that supports it, right? My SMB shares for corporate data for, you know, home profiles can just follow my desktops wherever they need to replicate to. So I don't need a bimodal design for how do I do my VDI failover and how I then bring like a NAS along to follow it.
Does the same concept of hydration and having local file access, does that still apply with Nutanix files?
How so?
Well, if I access my profile that just happened to live on a different node and I'm running from node 5, will it start to move my stuff over to node 5 if it wasn't already there?
Got it. No, so fundamentally, SMB traffic is by definition kind of not localized, right? It kind of almost can't be, right? It's an over the network conversation. So we don't chase down your desktop with like your home directory. Partly because, well, like think through the implications there. What if your desktop was running on a 1,000 user pod made up of 20 hardware nodes? But what if I could meet the the concurrency and the IO requirements of that files environment with like 5 file server VMs, right? So now I at most only have those running on 5 of the nodes if they were all spread out. So we don't chase down desktops that way. But we also, we don't need to, right? We can still have fantastic scale out performance kind of without that. We would kind of need like 1,000 file server VMs, I feel like, to really be able to do that if we could follow each user with their own data. It's an interesting idea. We don't do that. I don't think we need to, but it's certainly interesting.
Well, you mentioned architecture a while ago. If you're no more than 3 really fast hops away, and we're talking, you know, SMB type of delivery of data, then you probably don't need to.
That's fair as well, right? Like consider the right pattern of what do you do for your home directory. It's mostly a bulk read operation at logon, and then you're just sending back, you know, delta changes as you save an Excel sheet, save a Word doc, granular small updates, really. And in general, SMB workloads are... if you really want to put them on a dyno, right, and do like a load test, it's usually throughput related. It's rarely latency because, again, it's sort of conceded at the beginning. This is an over the network conversation that we're having.
Next one is Nutanix Objects. I think that one's actually
Objects as well, right, is an interesting one to benchmark. The key metric there is time to first byte, right? Because Objects is our S3 storage protocol, right? So S3 is the web native method of storing bulk data, but using an HTTP conversation. So it's meant to let you go anywhere on the globe and access this data store. It's like how Netflix delivers you movies over the internet. So if you sit down and watch a movie tonight, what's the latency for delivering that movie? Well, in some ways, some of those bits took 2 hours to get to you because that's how long a movie is 2 hours. So latency is another metric that for Objects design kind of isn't really in play. It's not pertinent. Time to first byte is, because you tell Netflix, I want to watch this movie. You care when you start seeing it, right? If it took 2 hours to think about it and then sent it to all down to you in 2 seconds, that's less useful than if you had the first minute of the movie in 3 seconds and it would stream the rest of it out to you.
Right.
So time to first byte for sure. But then again, similar to files, right? That ability for now for object storage, usually that also gets to be potentially huge scale, right? We can chew up hundreds of terabytes. We can do petabytes worth of object design. And that's usually more data than you want to have fail over. Objects is more commonly replicated as a data store level, right? Not data store in Nutanix sense, but more of an object store level, right? I'll write to my Charlotte S3 object store and then have it replicate to Sacramento and have it available in both. And since it's all sort of a web-based, HTTP-based conversation, I can do fun load balancing. I can just point my clients to point to the new object store. It has a different kind of availability model.
This next one I find interesting, especially in a VDI world where I've got master images that really do need to be backed up or even persistent images. What's Nutanix Mine all about? That's a new one to me as well.
Yeah. So Mine, a newer workload for Nutanix that maybe isn't what people first think about us for, but paired up with objects, right, with that S3 storage offering and that ability to get to petabyte scale quite easily. That combined with all the traditional Nutanix goodness, scale out software-defined storage, rapid healing, no RAID, easy management, like we've talked about, integrated hypervisor, makes us a fantastic storage target for backups. And so then with Mine, we simply take that awesome storage DNA that we have, and we also then integrate with some backup providers out of the box. So you can literally buy it, and it hits your cabinet in the data center ready to run as like a Haiku or Veeam, flavored backup appliance. So there's actually very little integration for you to do. You can be, configuring your policies and backing up VMs, very rapidly. And if you want to bring your own storage provider, bring your own, backup provider for something like Commvault, things like that, then you can simply stand up the cluster, point your backup software to us as the target, and start sending us your backup data. And objects is a fantastic place to store that.
So question specifically though, on this VDI world that we're very active in, can I use Nutanix Mine to back up my master images?
You can and should, yeah.
Wow. And how about my persistent desktop workloads?
Yeah, I would say, for all VMs really, unless you've got a justification not to, keep those snapshots of those VMs on the cluster that they run on, because that's always going to be your fastest recovery tier. They are immutable. They can be deleted by an admin, but they can't be changed via really any process, right? They can't be changed maliciously. They can't be changed via an in-guest infection. So the snapshots are fantastic. That's your first line of defense. But then for sure, absolutely anything persistent, whether it's a server or a persistent desktop, absolutely needs to be a citizen for backups as well.
Right. Okay. So we got three more and then we're done. Calm for application orchestration. I think we've talked about that some, but anything special to call out for that?
Yeah. And it probably has plenty of interaction with all of the stuff right around, like, how do I do my, micro segmentation, how do I deploy data services like SMB or S3 storage, and the applications themselves. So sure, it's absolutely a critical, we could do 10 hours on it alone, but it's a critical part of your design, right? Which is kind of what the reference architecture is coaching you towards. Here's what you need to be thinking about. So grab the stock, look through it, and think about all the inflection points and decision points that you have to wrestle with.
Right. You can't avoid talking about Kubernetes these days and what Nutanix is doing there.
Yeah. Another component, right, to think about keeping that ball rolling around simplicity. If the end goal is to run containerized applications, probably on Kubernetes these days, then why spend the time hand building those clusters at the VM level when with Nutanix you literally click a button and say, "I would like a Kubernetes cluster," and it just builds it for you. And then you give your developers access to it, and they basically can't tell the difference between it and running on any other Kubernetes cluster in the world. Mm-hmm. So do more, do it faster, more simply. And I mean, kind of the underlying theme of all this, Nutanix support, second to none in the world, right? Commonly, customers all day, every day tell us, you know, I like talking to your support engineers. You guys solve my problems. You do it fast. All of which, you know, it doesn't happen by accident, right? It's all by design. So why not let your Kubernetes platform also get that level of support compared to, I don't know, Googling it?
Mm-hmm. and then finally, Era for databases as a service. We've had a podcast on that, but anything specific in the architecture around what is available to a Nutanix customer?
That one, yeah, I can think of ways that Era would have a very, very significant impact for sure on a reference architecture, on a new data center build out planning, because whenever I can apply Era to running the databases, I can potentially, depending on my cloning workflows and my copy data management, I can have drastically less storage than I would have thought I needed, right? A lot of enterprises, you know, sometimes run 10 copies of a given database. With Era on Nutanix, I can store that once and then just simply have 10 readable copies of it that I can then also clone and refresh at will. So that lets me need a lot less storage, get lots higher performance, and spend less time doing like backups and restores to make that all work. It also commonly, right, could inform a desire or a need for a possibly dedicated database clusters, right? Not for Nutanix reasons, we couldn't care less really, but the things you want to run on on the database servers probably want very high clock speed, right? Usually we look at like 3.2, 3.4, 3.6 gigahertz CPUs, because that's what databases want, which means narrower CPU sockets. That's in the 8, 12, 16 core territory. It's not the 20, 24s, 28s that we can do for regular server vert. So we want faster, narrower sockets on the CPU level. And we probably want, therefore, you know, only database workloads, right? We don't want a lot of other VMs junking up those nodes that we pay more money for that have better CPUs on them. We want to keep those, you know, purpose-built for databases exclusively. And I'm not even touching on database licensing, which also corrals you into that sort of buy fewer cores type of model. So it's for lots of reasons, you probably want to think about dedicated database clusters for all those reasons.
And is the future of Era in the Nutanix on-premises and in the future cloud world, is it does it have anything to do with big data and analytics that'll be able to be housed, or the data that can be pulled from these environments and leveraged?
That's a huge question. I'm sure at some point, absolutely, right? Yeah, I mean, big data is sort of, I'm hardly even qualified to probably just pontificate on it. But like, in some ways, it's a matter of, you know, what do you throw at your SQL server, and what do you, and where does it live, and how long do you live it? How long does it live there for, and what do you do with it, right? So reporting and analytics and so forth. Yeah, I mean, it almost would have to, right? To your question, it would have to have more interaction, more surface area as big data touches more of the world.
I think the answer is probably why not, you know, why, as you evolve this, why not, you know, use it for big data purposes, which that's above our pay grade, but why not at some point? We'll see what happens. Well, Jaira, I didn't really mean for that to be such a extensive conversation around where Nutanix is at and what it's doing, but I felt pretty clearly a few minutes into it, that's where it was going to go. But that was good. You did a great job, and hopefully the listeners get a lot of value out of hearing you talk through these wide range of specific things.
The one of my favorite topics is just helping people think about new things to think about. I would encourage all of our listeners to check out this new. So what this really is the third iteration, right? The V3 version of our private cloud. Hybrid cloud reference architecture. So give that a quick Google. You'll find it easily. It's linked on our recent blog posts. And even if your deployments look different than the decisions made in this document, it gives you a great framework to think about what should my deployments look like. So that's invaluable.
Well, we talked through all that and I didn't even look at it yet. And maybe you guys have the answer I'm looking for, but how many pages is this thing?
Ooh, easy ones. Yeah, here we go. Scrolling. The answer is a lot. The answer is more than 300. It's 318.
318. Okay, that's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. I'm going to pull it down now. It was funny the way you answered that. My son and I have a running joke. We went to a track meet, not last week, but the one before. and we heard a girl tell her friend to tell the other friend to get some seats at a restaurant. And her answer, like, how many do we need? Well, like a lot. It's like, okay, great. Well, a future generation, you ask them a question, it's going to be, well, like a lot.
That's specific and actionable.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is, my 12-year-old heard that and looked at me and like, well, Dad, that's not going to work out. And I'm like, no, it's not. But guess what? That's today's teenager. All right. Well, Jira, thanks for joining us. And Harvey, you know, we really had a great conversation. I learned a lot from Jira. Anything that we didn't cover that you'd want to bring up?
No, I mean, I think he hit all of the topics very well. I don't have to go behind him and clean up anything.
That's my goal.
That's right.
That's what success looks like.
Well, Jira, appreciate it. We'll do it again, not next week, but the week after that.
You bet. Talk to you all then.
Thank you.